Okay, so I've handed back graded exams and homework, and all of you got it. Those of you who are listening to this on the recording, see me before or after class to get your exam. The grade distribution I've written down. Some people are interested in that sort of thing. So there were three scores in the 90s, five scores in the 80s, five scores in the 70s, two in the 60s, one in the 50s, two in the 40s, and one in the 20s. So, actually, so 13 people above 70, which I regard as really good. The median score was a 77, which also is pretty typical for a math course. It means that half the scores were above 77 and half were below 77. So, you know, if you got above 70, you may not be totally happy with your grade, but at least you're passing. If you got below 70, you probably need to do something a little different on the next exam. And if you want to come talk to me during office hours, I can give you some ideas about what you might want to do different. So, I don't plan to work all the problems, but I'll work any problem that you want. But I do want to go through the solution and just give you some highlights or lowlights, as the case may be. For the most part, I think people did pretty well on problems one and two. I mean, there were a few minor mistakes, and I wasn't looking for works of art on the graphs. It's something that's technically correct. Here, hold on. Take a solution from the pile. Here's your homework. Let me give you your exam. That's okay. Don't worry about it. Okay, so, like I was saying, first page, mostly you guys did pretty well on it. I was looking for two particular plots, the phase-line diagram and the solution curves in the YT plane, and then also enumerating the equilibria, or somehow indicating them. And I just want to mention, there is no such thing as stable as an equilibrium. The best you can do is asymptotically stable. So in case if I circled stable, and you think that's right, notice that there is no such thing as stable equilibrium, at least not in this context. So, any questions on the first page? Now, if you have some specific question about how I graded your test, probably best to see me after class. Okay, so, but general questions I'd be happy to entertain. Problem number three. Now, You know, I'm still learning in how to teach this course. What I intended for this problem was that you should go ahead and plug the solution in and see if it satisfies the equation. That's really what it's asking. Determine whether this function is a solution. Show all work. It's not asking you to solve the differential equation. However, there were about four or five people who went ahead and solved it, and it is a solvable problem. Next time I teach the course, I won't give you a problem that you can solve on this one. So hopefully you'll recognize that you have to plug in to see if it satisfies the equation. Again, most of you did that okay. Any questions on problem three? Okay, problem four, A and B. In both cases, these are linear equations, and you would use the linear existence and uniqueness theorem to determine whether a solution exists that is unique. Because P of T is equal to 2 over T, and T naught is 0, T naught is not in the domain of P of T, nor is any open interval about T naught in the domain of P of T. So therefore, part A, the solution does not exist. And you need to say that. You need to be specific about your answer to that question. Part B, it does exist, but the solution exists and is unique only in the interval from negative pi over 2 to 1. Because of the nature of tangent, you can see the tangent graph plotted on the left, as well as the fact that you're dividing by 1 minus t, so 1 cannot be included in the interval. So, any questions on that? So, problem 5. We did this problem in class. So I think most of you got this correct. It's probably a good idea to clear the fractions, both in the numerator and the denominator, and write it the way I've written it. There were one or two people who don't know how to take a reciprocal. You know, if you have, like in this case, you have 1 over y, and let's say negative, is equal to t to the fourth over 4 plus c, and set the negative to the other side. So 1 over y is equal to negative t to the fourth divided by 4. And you can still say plus c here. Now the reciprocal of this is going to be y is equal to 1 over negative t to the fourth over 4 plus c. That c has to go in the denominator. There were one or two people that wrote the plus c out here. You can't just take the reciprocal and move this c out in front or out to the side. It doesn't work. Think about the algebra there. So there were other similar, maybe not as serious mistakes, but that was one I remember seeing. Yes?
How did you move the 4 to the top?
I'm sorry, what?
How did you move the 4 to the top in this case?
Multiply both top and bottom by 4.
So 4c just turns into c?
Yeah, 4c is c. It's arbitrary. As long as it remains arbitrary. Now, once you apply the initial condition and c is no longer arbitrary, becomes some number, then yeah, you can't do that then. Okay. This is another problem that we did in class or on the homework or someplace. Most of you got it right. There were a few people who, in multiplying both sides by t to the negative 2, forgot to multiply the c. You know, we're talking about basic algebra skills here. If you multiply both sides by something, you need to multiply both sides, and you need to multiply every term on both sides. So you get a c times t to the negative 2. You don't just get a c. There was one person that said C times T to the negative 2 is C. No, that doesn't work. T is a variable. C is an arbitrary constant. You can't just take anything that has a C in it and turn it into a C. Any questions so far? Okay. Problem number 7. I'm going to ask you to put the food away. Now, we didn't work this exact problem, but there were several that were like this, and this one had an initial condition. So most of you did okay on it. One of the things I was looking for was, did you get basically to this midpoint where you had d by dt of e to the negative 2t times x equals negative 4e to the 2t. And a number of you got to this point. I think one or two people had an 8 here, but everything else was correct. A couple of people had the wrong mu, the wrong integrating factor, and had e to the 2t instead of e to the negative 2t. But basically, if you got to this point and then somehow made a mistake at the end, I took off fewer points. I think I took, if you got to this point and then had the wrong answer, I took off 3 points on this problem. So, you know, the hard stuff is getting to this point. The integral's actually pretty easy. So some people come in, let me hand out. By the way, if you just came in, come on up and get a solution. What's your name?
David.
So everybody got solutions? Let me go ahead and do the homeworks now. David?
Yes.
Ted? Okay. Any questions? We're up to problem 7 on the test. Easy so far, right? Nobody's saying yes. Is it hard? You think this test was hard? I'm curious. Nobody wants to answer. You know, it's okay if you answer. Say yes. No? Easy?
I didn't think it was particularly difficult. It's just minor mistakes that I made that brought down my game. But some of the problems I'm not trying to shoot me up, but not.
Okay, so.
I agree.
So easy problems, but they tripped you up a little bit.
The word problems.
We're going to talk about the word problems. Okay, so number 8. Now this was exact, and there were, I think, one or two people who thought it was not exact. But if you are careful with the minus signs, you would see that it was in fact exact. And then you can see the solution from there to the end. It's not very long, not very difficult. And many of you got this problem right. One thing you want to be careful of And by the way, it doesn't. Some of us disagreed on the sign of the terms at the end, but that doesn't matter because there's an arbitrary constant there. So I said F is equal to T minus T cubed Y squared plus Y cubed, and that's equal to something. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But so some of you had, in fact, I think a lot of you, I'm not sure why, it has to do with the way you set up the problem, which was maybe different than the way I did, but you had, say, T cubed Y squared minus Y cubed minus T is equal to whatever. Now, there were one or two people that had zeros here. That is not correct. This number here is an arbitrary constant, so you need to put a C there. Unless you have an initial condition which tells you that this is supposed to be zero. You could put it on the other side and say plus C equals zero, and that would be fine also. So, and then there were one or two people who didn't have anything. They just had F equals this. This, by the way, is not the solution of your differential equation. It has to be something of this form, and this is an implicit representation of the solution. So, in the examples that we did, I clearly showed that this was equal to C and then left it that way, and that was the answer. And the way you prove that you're correct is differentiating the whole thing with respect to T, and then solving for dy dt, and you'll find that it is equal to the differential equation that you started with. Okay. Problem number 9, skydiver parachute opens. A number of you tried to solve the differential equation. By the way, it says ma equals mg minus rho mv. Rho is drag coefficient that is a property of the parachute itself and its relation to the atmosphere. M is the mass of the system, the person hanging from the parachute. And A is intended to be dv dt. And if you didn't recognize that, you probably had trouble solving the problem. But so you cancel the M's and you get dv dt is equal to g minus rho v. So that's your differential equation. Now, a number of you set out to solve that differential equation. It's not a terribly difficult problem to solve. It's linear. In fact, it's separable. But there's nowhere in here that asks you to solve the equation. What does it ask for? A general formula for what? For terminal velocity. How would you get that? The VDT is equal to zero. So you get rho V is equal to G. Now there was one person that left it in that form. That's not telling me what V is. You got to solve for V. So then V is equal to G divided by rho. I wanted a general form. Now, some of you substituted 32 for G, but that only works in the British system. I didn't take points off for that, but G is the acceleration due to gravity at the surface of the Earth, and it can be different things in different systems of units. So this is the correct answer. Notice how easy that was. You didn't have to solve the differential equation. A few people came up during the test and said, what is the terminal velocity? And that's a valid question. If you don't know, if you haven't thought about terminal velocities before or, you know, this kind of thing. But the word terminal should be kind of a clue. You're looking at the behavior of the system as T goes to infinity. And that if the equilibrium happens at all, it's going to be where dv dt is equal to zero. So So that's the answer to part A, and really couldn't be any easier than that. Part B, find the terminal velocity. So once you know this, then you can plug in numbers, and I give you rho is equal to 1.2 somethings, and g is 32. And when you plug those in, you get 26.6 repeated or something like that. And a large number of you got that number correct. So you had the correct, even if you didn't have quite the right answer here. And by the way, if you solve the equation and you leave it, v is equal to g over rho plus something, I don't know what it would be, I forget, you know, some coefficient times e to the negative something, that's not the terminal velocity. What do you have to do further to get the terminal velocity? You have to take the limit as t goes to infinity. And so, if this was your answer, I didn't give you full credit for that, because that is not the terminal velocity. That is the velocity is a function of time. Terminal velocity is where you take t goes to infinity. And then you get g over rho, because this is, there's a t in here somewhere. And so as t goes to infinity, that negative sign on the exponential is going to make that term go to zero, and you get the g over rho, which you could have gotten so much simpler if you'd just done it this way. Now, it doesn't mean that I wouldn't next time ask you to solve the equation and find, you know, what is the velocity 7 seconds after he jumped out of the plane? You know, that's a valid question, but that's not the question that I asked on this particular problem. So, always step back, go slow, read the problem carefully, answer the question that's being asked. Because, you know, I'm grading these things and thinking, why is this person solving the differential equation? I didn't say to do that. And it adds a whole bunch of work to your life, and it makes you miserable. Right? Whereas you could have walked out of here last Thursday with a smile on your face. Instead, there was frustration and other emotions. So, okay, so that was part B. What are the units for rho? Well, if the final answer here is, let's do it over here. So, v is in feet per second. But you have something that is feet per second squared divided by something. Well, even if you don't know anything at all, make this, you know, r, and now let's solve for r. So multiply both sides by r, divide both sides by feet per second. So you get r, that's going to be the units down here, the units of rho, is equal to feet per second squared divided by feet per second. And what's going to happen? These feet are going to cancel. One of these seconds is going to cancel, and you end up with 1 over seconds. And that's the answer to part C. Okay? Questions on this? Okay. These are all free points, right? Should be. Okay, problem number 10. Pond contains 1 million gallons of water and an unknown amount of an undesirable chemical. Some people came up and said, well, how much is in the water? An unknown amount. Well, that seemed to present a problem. So I said, well, just work it. Assume that there's none in there initially. Does it matter how much is in there initially? No. Because you're putting something in with a fixed concentration forever. You're just emptying out at the same rate forever. What is the concentration of the contents in the tank as t goes to infinity? Well, it's going to be whatever the concentration is of the stuff that's coming in. because it just replaces everything that's in there. Eventually, because of perfect mixing and it goes forever, eventually the concentration of the stuff in the tank is going to be whatever the concentration is of the stuff that's coming in. Well, what is the stuff, what is the concentration of the input? Well, it's point, what is it, point 0.01 grams per gallon?
Yeah.
And so you multiply that by a million gallons, what do you get? So times 1 million gallons, the gallons cancel, and you get total number of grams. So a million times 0.01 is 10,000. That's the answer. Now, I also asked, so that was the last sentence. How much of the chemical will be in the pond after a very long time? 10,000 grams. I mean, easy.
How can it just multiply the amount coming in?
Because, intuitively, the concentration of the input liquid is eventually going to replace everything that's in the tank. Right, if you're, I mean, that's the whole basis of washing, right? When you wash the dishes and you got soap and you're running clear water out of the tap, well, what ends up, how much soap do you have at the end? Zero. Why? Because there's zero soap in the water that's coming out of the tap. You know, eventually, whatever, if it was soapy water coming out of the tap, then you'd have soap all over the place. I mean, the kitchen would fill up with soap. But that's not what's happening. You've got an input of 0.01 grams per gallon, and eventually the whole tank is going to be 0.01 grams per gallon. Now, you could get there by another way. You could write the differential equation, which I did ask you to do. It says, write a differential equation for the amount of chemical in the pond at any time. So, some of you didn't know how to compute the rate in and the rate out, and got those parts wrong, but, and you have to remember, the rate out is based on the volume of water that's already in the tank, or in the pool, whatever we call this thing. So, some of you didn't get that second term correct in the differential equation, but the equation that I boxed in the center there of the page, that's the differential equation that you want. And you don't need units at that point. And now, how do you find the equilibrium amount? Q is the amount. Well, dq dt is zero, so you do the same thing that we did with the parachute. Set that right-hand side equal to zero and solve, and you get Q is equal to 10,000 grams. So you don't have to rely on your intuition to get this problem right. You solve, and you don't solve the differential equation explicitly, you just set the dq dt equal to zero and solve that resulting equation, and you get the right answer. It's not to say that I couldn't ask you that question, what is the amount as a function of time, but I did not in this problem. Yes?
Well, why do you say dq dt equal to zero?
And because it's equilibrium.
That's equilibrium, but don't you in the limit as equal to infinity?
Isn't that the same thing? I mean, everything that we've been doing, I mean, there are problems that don't have an equilibrium. And there are problems that you can't set the QDT equal to zero and solve and get the equilibrium behavior. But, you know, when you do something like this, what are you really doing? What you're doing is you're setting that the right hand side of that differential equation equal to zero, and then this is going to be an equilibrium point. That's why we have, you know, we have another graph here, which is f of y versus y. Now this is only for autonomous equations. But the idea is that equilibrium can be something that happens as t goes to infinity. Other questions on this? Okay, so that was the test. Any questions on the test in general? Again, for those people who came in late, The median score was 77, so half of the people got above 77, half got below. If you're interested in talking about your grade, come see me. We can talk about the grade, or email me.
Sign. Send that around.
So any questions, comments, anything about homework?
Yes.
Yes.
Problem number 9.
27?
27, yes.
What's your question?
Well, I was trying to solve it, but I got stuck, and I searched for number 9, and they told me to do long division, but it didn't work.
Okay, so if we'll get to the point, if there's a difficult integral that I don't want to spend a lot of time on, I'll just say, you know, you can solve that integral. But let's go ahead and do what we're supposed to do on the problem. So, dy dt is equal to y to the 4th plus 2xy cubed minus 3x squared y squared minus 2x cubed y divided by 2x squared y squared minus 2x cubed y minus 2x to the 4th Now, in a problem like this, what are we supposed to do? V is equal to what?
Y over x.
So, therefore, y is equal to vx. And so, I'm going to change the left side, but did I write dy dt? This should be dy dx. So, I'll change that in a moment. But then, so this becomes v to the 4th, x to the 4th, plus 2x v cubed x cubed, which is 2v x to the 4th cubed. All right, thank you. Minus 3 x squared v squared x squared, which is 3v squared x to the 4th. Minus 2vx to the 4th divided by 2x to the 4th v squared, so v squared x to the 4th minus 2vx to the 4th minus 2x to the 4th. Now the x to the 4th will all cancel. So you get v to the 4th plus 2v cubed minus 3v squared minus 2v all over 2v squared minus 2v minus 2. And now I'm going to go ahead and factor a v out of the top. So I get v times. Now, you're saying that someone told you to divide.
It seemed more dice all night.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad idea, actually.
But remember that you have to substitute divide x.
Yeah. I'm not done.
So you have a.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. I do need to. I got to combine those terms. So then. So dy, so we want dy dx, which is equal to x dv dx plus v. So first, times the derivative of the second, plus the second, times the derivative of the first. And so replace this, so we get x dv dx plus v. Subtract v from both sides, so we get x dv dx is equal to this thing. So I'm just going to move this over here. So minus v, and then multiply by 2v squared minus 2v minus 2, and then 2v squared minus 2v minus 2. So this equals, so v to the fourth, plus 2v cubed, plus 2v cubed is plus 4v cubed.
To the minus.
Where's the minus v?
Yes.
Minus 2v cubed. Yes. You're right. So this is subtracting. So those cancel. Okay, that's good. So these guys go away. Plus 2v squared minus 3v squared is minus v squared. And then plus 2v minus 2v, so the 2v's cancel. Divide by, now I'm going to factor a 2 out, so I get 2 times v squared minus v minus 1.
And that's where I stopped.
Okay, well, so this is the difference of squares. So I would try, you know, this will give us an idea of what might factor, maybe something will cancel. So you get V, squared plus 1 times v squared minus 1. Is that right?
V squared plus v. V squared minus v.
You said you can factor the v squared and then it makes a simplification of v.
Yeah, let's do that. So thank you. So, so this is v squared times v squared minus 1 over 2 v squared minus v minus 1. And so v squared times v plus 1 times v minus 1 over 2 v squared minus v minus 1. Now does... Okay, so let's see if... So we can use the quadratic form. Well, actually, let's just try to factor it directly. So
you actually don't have to. When you do the dx to the side and flip everything and invert, it actually becomes a very breakable division.
I know, but if it can be simplified, I want to simplify it.
Right, so V1, no, it's not going to factor that way. Okay, so what you're saying, and I think you're right, so let's
separate.
Yep, separate. So you get two times V squared minus V minus 1 divided by V squared V plus 1 V minus 1 times dy, or dv, is equal to, and then dx over x. Now this can be expanded by partial fractions and integrated. Was it you that asked, or? Okay. How would you do partial fractions on this?
Over v squared plus v over v plus 1.
Yeah, so, you know, you're going to have 2 v squared minus v minus 1 divided by v squared v plus 1 times v minus 1 is equal to a v plus b over v squared plus c over v plus 1 plus d over v minus 1. And with a little bit of algebra, you can solve for a, b, c, and d. And once you have that, then you can integrate it. And you, any questions about that? I don't want to spend the time to do that right now. You okay with that? Okay. Other questions on homework?
So we didn't cross out the V over 4. We did bar 4.
Well, I factored out the V squared.
Like up there, you crossed it out up there. That's it.
Oh, I crossed it out because I wrote it here.
Oh.
It didn't go
yeah,
away.
Yeah, I was
just,
how you canceled it.
Yeah, I didn't cancel it. I just bookkeeping.
I had a question about homework data coming in here.
Okay.
So I want you to be learning them, and they actually confuse me more about this. So it's like, is dy dx equal x homogeneous or no? Dy
no.
Over dx equal
it's not homogeneous.
It's not homogeneous.
No. Well, hold on. So dy dx
equals x.
Yeah, dy dx equals x. So, yeah, if you write it in the right form, no, it's not, because you've got, so if you had dy dx plus something times y equals 0, that would be homogeneous. But you have something times x here, and so your right hand side is x. It's not 0.
But then there's also the linear part of it. It's like y.
It's linear, but it's not homogeneous.
So if it was like y prime plus y plus x equals 0.
So y prime plus y
plus x equals 0.
No, plus x. You move the x over on the other side. So y prime plus y is equal to negative x. That's not homogeneous. That's not homogeneous.
And that's
not
linear as well.
It's linear.
It's linear, but not homogeneous.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you just got to make sure that it's in the right form before you make those kind of determinations. Yes?
I noticed that in a book and online, I found a similar way of proving homogeneity, and I'm wondering...
You mean, like this kind?
No, for the how you're proving that it's homogeneous or not homogeneous, where they basically do lambda t or f of lambda x, lambda y.
That's the homogeneous of this kind.
Okay.
Yeah. This is a homogeneous function of degree 4. This is a homogeneous function of degree 4. And when you divide them out, the x's will cancel. That's why we do it this way.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not this kind of homogeneous. This is not homogeneous anyway, but you know what I'm saying.
So the lambda method only works on this, not on this.
Yes, that's right. On the one on the left, not the one on the right. Yeah, that's what I was trying to say before, last week, when I said it's an unfortunate use of the word, the same word in both cases. We're going to talk about homogeneous equations. This is homogeneous. But so is this. And they mean very different things. So
I think that one's homogeneous, but linearly homogeneous. And the other one's just homogeneous on degrees.
You know, I think that if you try to apply that standard throughout the course, you're going to just get confused. That's why I wanted to call this a homogeneous substitution. And these are homogeneous equations. This is a homogeneous equation. So if you're using the homogeneous substitution technique, then you would do it on this kind of function. But that's different than what we mean by homogeneous equation.
And to check that, you use the lambda method.
No, you don't check it by the lambda method. You look at the degree. So it's fourth degree, fourth degree, fourth degree, fourth degree. Fourth degree, fourth degree, fourth degree. If all of the terms are the same degree, then it will be of type homogeneous substitution.
But that one's degree 0 because it cancel and...
But the numerator's degree 4, the denominator's degree 4, but I agree that they cancel, so it's degree 0.
And it's the same degree as DOY of x, which is degree 0 too.
That's not required.
No.
I don't think so. Well, maybe. I wouldn't. Well, you could probably classify this as homogeneous.
That's the way I see it.
The truth is, once we finish section 2.7, you're probably not going to see it again until the final exam. An occasional problem will come up where you have to do a substitution, but not very often. Yes.
When you say, and I want to be very clear, when you say we're not going to see it until the final exam, does that mean we're not going to see it on the second exam?
No, you will see it on the second exam.
Okay.
Yeah, we didn't test on it in the first exam. So after the second exam, you won't see it again until the final exam. That's right. Thank you for the clarification. Okay. Yes?
Unrelated. Do you want your test back?
No.
Okay.
I want you to study them. I want you to become intimate with them. Take it to bed with you.
Don't tell us about it.
Yeah, just, you know, make sure you understand everything that happened on that test. And including the solutions. I mean, I did an experiment last time I taught this course, which was last summer. I did an experiment. The final exam, the two-part final, but the second part, actually, I think I may have done this with both of the parts, but the second part, I read the entire exam, word for word, out loud to the students the week before the final exam. People still bombed it. Didn't matter. You know why? Because nobody believes that I'm going to actually ask those questions. Or they don't care, or they think they already know, or whatever. And so the students that I knew could do it, did it. And the students who couldn't do it, didn't do it. It doesn't matter how much information you give them. I mean, I practically told you what was going to be on the test this time. And still had people that bombed it. Now, I'm not making a personal judgment here. I'm just making a statement of fact. I can read you the test out loud, and it probably wouldn't make any difference. Those of you who know how to do it are going to do well on the test, whether I tell you what's on the test or not. And those of you who can't figure it out are not going to figure it out, no matter how much information I give you about the test. And educators would be fascinated to study this phenomenon in greater detail. But does that make sense? I don't know what the message is there. You know, study like hell. You're going to have to do that in any case. Even if I tell you what's on the test, you're still going to have to perform. Yes?
I want to say, flagging back my head somewhere, saying, is there a test or an exam that is take-home in the
no.
semester?
The math department does not allow that at all. We had a senior faculty member who did that once in a while, and that got shut down. And give you projects to do and take home, but not tests. Okay, any other questions? So we're all ready on the homework. You guys are ready to hand it in on Thursday? Yes?
What section is it?
2.7.
I thought it was just that one.
It's all we covered last week.
I know. So even though the schedule says differently, it's only
what? No, it doesn't say different. What does it say? Last Tuesday we did 2.7, and then on Thursday we had the test.
Thank you.
Do you have the schedule in front of you?
Yeah, I see that now. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, so today we're going to do 8.1. Now, if we had more time, I would do 8.2 and 8.3, but I don't think we really have enough time to cover those sections in any great detail. They're all related. 8.1 is Euler's method, and you probably remember this from Calc 2. If not, I'll remind you today, so you'll be up on Euler's method. 8.2 covers error conditions and error bounds on numerical solutions of differential equations. And some of you might be very interested in that. In the real world, nobody solves differential equations directly, symbolically. In grad school, for my PhD, I modeled neural networks with differential equations. And it's hopeless to think that you're going to solve a system like that, because they're very complicated differential equations, and many of them in the system, they're all first order, but still it's you've got 1,000 neurons in your neural network, you got 1,000 equations, and you're just not going to be able to solve it directly and symbolically, but you can program it on a computer. And so that's what we do. So we use a variety of techniques, numerical techniques, to find the solution. And really, that's the way it is in the real world. I mean, even if you're launching a rocket into outer space, you're not going to solve a differential equation to do that, because it's just too complicated. You've got too many factors involved in more than one equation. So you have computers that do that. And so how would you solve a differential equation on a computer? Well, Euler's method is probably the simplest. And again, you studied it in Calc 2, but we're going to go over it again. But it's Euler's method is not very accurate. It takes a very small step size, because you're stepping through time. You start at t equals 0, let's say, and then you go to t equal 0.1, and already you have a substantial amount of error. So you probably choose t equal 0.01, but even that's going to give you too much error. So maybe you do t equals, the next step is t equals 0.001. Well, now you've got all this computation that you're having to do to get anywhere in time, and it's a very slow process. And so Euler's method is not very good for practical applications, and so there are modifications to Euler's method, and there's another method called run and cut it. Yes?
Is this like gradient descent?
No, I think gradient descent would be more appropriate for optimization problems. Because you're not computing a gradient when you do Euler's method. I mean, you are using a derivative, but... And it's not like Newton's method where you're trying to zero in on a root of an equation. I don't know that I would call that gradient descent either. I mean, call it what you want. It's I'm going to derive it and show you how it works, and we'll do an example, and then you'll have a few problems like this in homework. And so I was going to mention Runge-Kutta. So it's a much more complicated technique. It involves more computation, but you can live with larger step sizes, and so overall the process goes a lot faster. And so I used Runge-Kutta in grad school, and that was adequate for what we needed to do. There's also a variation on Euler's method that is faster and more accurate. But Runge-Kutta, there are actually several variations of Runge-Kutta that will give you different levels of performance. And you try to minimize the error for a certain step size. Because, as we'll see, you're having to step through time to get to a certain point where you want to know the answer. So, okay. So let me just erase all this. And there are variations on these four systems of differential equations. We're only going to solve one equation at a time. We'll talk about systems later, but we're not going to circle back and do Euler's for a system. Although they do, because chapter 8 is toward the end of this, in fact, it's the last printed chapter in this book. Chapters 9, 10, and 11 are online, as I mentioned earlier in the course. So by the time you get to chapter 8, we've already done systems of equations. So they do have some discussion of that. I think in 8.4, actually, 8.4. So suppose you have some solution curve that looks like this, and we're going to start with, and this is going to be y versus x, and we'll say that this is x naught, which is our initial guess, or it's our initial condition, and of course then you have y naught, which is the y value at the initial condition. And now we think we know something about this function. And in fact, what we know is that dy dx is equal to f of x comma y. Right? So it's, we can use lowercase f or uppercase f. I don't think it matters that much as long as you're consistent. And so at the point x naught, y naught, we have some derivative, and we
we're familiar with this concept from our slope fields that we talked about before. And remember, if you're going to do anything serious with slope fields, you probably want to use a computer. And there's that link in Blackboard to a slope field calculator that you might need. If you want to, I think there's a few problems in the homework that sort of ask you to come up with a slope field for some of these equations and to see if you're going to be able to use Euler's method and get any reasonable solution from it. But, so at... now, I'm going to... so the derivative here is, of course, f of x comma y. But now, let me draw this, give myself some space. And let's call this h. And that's going to be our next iteration. We're going to try to figure out what's going on with this function. We're going to compute it at x0, and then we're going to compute it at x1. And we're going to see what's happening. Probably don't need this to be quite so dramatic, or something like that. And so, now what's the relationship between x1 and x0? Specifically. Yeah, so x1 is equal to x0 plus h. And we can sort of generalize this. So x2 is equal to x1 plus h. And just keep going. So xn is equal to xn minus 1 plus h. Okay. Now, what about the y? Well, y naught is given. And so y1 is equal to y naught plus, so this is y naught. Where is y1? Is it up here? Is it here? It's right here. You can already see what the problem is. What's the difficulty? It doesn't touch the curve. Will it ever touch the curve? No. If we knew where the curve was, we wouldn't have to do the stupid numerical technique. Right? Right? I mean, you're trying to find the solution that goes through the initial condition. And I said this is the solution. If we knew the solution, we wouldn't be doing this. Right? We'd be at home eating pizza or something. Okay? So, we don't know what the solution is. Our best guess of what the solution is happens to be that point right there. That's why I won. Now, the difficulty, of course, is that there's an error between the actual y1 and the computed y1, and we'd like that error to be as small as possible. Now, you're going to see that we're going to make we're hoping that this curve is pretty closed here. I haven't drawn it that way. But let's assume that we're going to use the slope that's there. Now, I haven't computed y1 yet, but you see where we're going with this. We're never going to be on the curve, but we're hoping that the slope follows the slope of the curve. In fact, what we're hoping, so the difficulty that we're having is that the calculated value is putting us not on our solution curve, but on a neighboring solution curve. I assume you're not surfing the web and doing all sorts of...
No, I'm not. I have work pulled up. Or I have to.
A what?
I have to have work pulled up.
Okay.
Yeah, just be careful with the cord running around because people will trip on that and then I'll be liable.
Okay, will do.
I know that the magnet will disengage. If
I'll make sure it keeps engaged.
No, you want it to become disengaged.
I'm going to hold onto that cable so that person slips and breaks his neck.
Yes. That's exactly what we want. Okay. Okay, so how do we get... let me just finish this thought. So the computed value of our next point is actually on a neighboring curve. Can you imagine that? I mean, imagine that you have some neighboring curve that's running through here, and maybe it goes like that. What we want is for the neighboring curve to mirror or track the curve that we want. And if that is the case, then we won't be too far off. And if our step size is small enough, then the error won't be that significant, and we can live with the error. And in fact, you can have an error from the very first step. No matter which technique you use, no matter how small step size you use, you're always going to have error. The question is whether you can live with it. Can you build a bridge with it? Can you launch a rocket to the moon or to Mars with it? Well, as long as you have feedback and you can make course corrections and stuff like that, I think you can pretty much live with it. But do you see, you're on some neighboring curve, and your hope is that neighboring curve isn't going to go off and do some weird thing. Because what you're trying to do is track on this curve. As long as the neighboring curves all have the same sort of relative behavior, then this technique will work. At least the curves that you're interested in. Now, you know, there's this thing called bifurcation. If you have, let's say you have a bunch of curves that do this, and then maybe there's something that happens, and then boom, you know, you're over here. And it's like the flapping of the butterfly's wings causes you to be on one side versus the other. If you're on the left side, happiness. If you're on the right side, despair, right? Because now you're going to be over here, and you think you're over here. You think you're following the right curve. Does that make sense? You understand what I'm saying?
We saw a lot of that in, I can't remember which section, but they were going into determining a line where the pattern of behavior of this equation changes. It's like an equilibrium line, but I don't know if that's the right term.
Yeah, it depends on what's causing it, but yeah, you'll have a, null, I mean, sometimes they're called null lines. We're going to talk about that later in the course. But yeah, we'll have very different behavior on one side versus on the other. And if you're not on the right side, if you think you're tracking this curve, but your error takes you over to the other domain, now you're over here and you're lost, right? You won't get the right answer. And you can so the slope field will help you find that, because you can look at the slope field and say, well, I have my initial condition is there. But if your initial condition is right there, then you're in trouble because you could easily get bounced into the wrong area. So anyway, so we're going to compute y1. Well, what is y1? Well, what is this? What is the ratio of the sides of this rectangle or triangle? What's the ratio? Is this thing, right? Because that's the derivative, dy dx. This is dy, this is dx. So dy divided by dx is the ratio. So now if I, if I take dy dx and I call dx h, then I'm going to be multiplying. Now, I need to start with my y-naught here. So y-naught plus h times f of what?
Dx.
By the way, you guys are all going to have to know this equation for the test, because I'm not going to give you Euler's method on the test. I'll say use Euler's method, and you're going to have to come up with the equation. So you need to understand how to get this. You think, well, I'll just memorize it the night before the test. People who do that usually don't memorize it correctly. So be able to derive it. Understand where it comes from, and then you will be golden. You know, you'll be one of the A students rather than one of the other students. What do I write here?
X what?
X not.
X not, comma?
Why not?
Why not, yes. Because the slope is being computed at this point, at the point X not, Y not. So this is kind of a generic statement of the derivative, but if I want to know exactly what this Y1 value is, it's Y not plus this distance here, the dy, but the dy is the f dx, or the f times h, right? So dy is equal to f of x naught comma y naught times h. I put the h in the front because that's customary. But that dy, that's a delta y, that's a change in y, that's not the absolute y value, that's the change in the y, so we have to add that to the y naught. So that's why we have y naught plus, and then your delta y, or your dy. And if h is really small, then this is going to be a good approximation. And if this is going on, if we can rely on, you know, these curves to kind of move in the same direction, then we'll probably not be too far off. Okay, so now what's the next one? Y2 is equal to what?
Y1.
Y1 plus h times f of
x1,
comma y1. Notice we're using old values to compute new values. So in computing the x1, we're using the x0, x sub 0. In computing x2, we use x1. So we're always using the old value of x to compute the new value of x. And likewise with the y's, we use the old value of x, I'm sorry, the old value of y and the old value of x. And then dot, dot, dot. And then y sub n is equal to y sub n minus 1 plus h times f of what?
X sub n minus 1.
X sub n minus 1, comma, y sub n minus 1. Now, this is the algorithm. We start with an x naught, y naught, and then we go through these steps to compute x1, x2, x3, y1, y2, y3, and so on. And you stop when you get to the x value that you're interested in. You don't need to go any further than that. Okay? Now I want to do an example. Not really a whole lot I want to say about this, except to do the example. You need to have good bookkeeping. And so I'm going to show you a way that I do it. And so let me rewrite these over here just so we have them. So x sub n is equal to x sub n minus 1 plus h. Y sub n is equal to y sub n minus 1 plus h times f of x sub n minus 1 comma y sub n minus 1. And that is Euler's method. So I usually make a table. Let's see. Let's pick a specific problem first. So y prime is equal to x plus y squared. And an initial condition, let's say y of 0 is 0. Now, it doesn't have to be y of 0 is equal to 0. In this case, it is, but it doesn't, you know, you can have any initial condition that you want, assuming that the solution exists and is unique and so on. Before you start something like this, you might want to have a theorem that tells you that. Now, in a real problem, you're probably talking about nonlinear equations, and then you don't really know for sure anyway. So we just do the best we can. So we're going to compute this. Let's start with a step size of h is equal to 0.2 and find y of 0.4. And so this is going to be really easy because we already are given 0. We're going to have point x equals 0.2, and then we're going to have x equals 0.4. So we don't have to do much computation. So you'll see how this works. But I make a table. So I usually list n, the number of iterations that we are at currently. X sub n, y sub n. I would also do f of x sub n comma y sub n, and h of f of x sub n comma y sub n. Now, some of you are going to resist and say, "You know what? I don't want to work that hard." Guess what happens to those people? They get the wrong answer. You know, if you're really careful and if you're doing this in your head, you can probably sometimes get the right answer just by randomly writing things down on the page. But I hope one of the things that you learn, if you don't already know this, is to be organized, to do good bookkeeping, and then it's easy for you to do the work, and it's easy for me to grade your work, and you're also more likely to get the right answer when you behave that way. If you're just trying to do everything in your head, you're all over the place, it's just so easy to make mistakes. So, plus you end up doing more work than you really need to do. And I know this sounds, it almost is childish in its simplicity, but I'd rather you get the right answer than look cool. Right? I think it's important to adopt a philosophy that allows you to get the right answer reliably. Then, you know, if somebody says, "Oh, he makes you do a table." Yeah, I think that's a good thing. Okay, so n equals 0. What's x sub 0? Did I forget to write? Okay, so x sub 0 is 0. What's y sub 0?
0.
0. What's f of x sub 0 comma y sub 0?
0.
So this is right here, this is your f of x comma y. Right? So 0 plus 0 is 0. And then h times 0 is 0. Now, you think, well, that's pretty stupid. I mean, we just did a whole row of zeros. Well, this is not always going to be 0. This won't be necessarily 0. This won't necessarily be 0. In that case, this won't be zero, this won't be zero. Why am I separating this from this? To give you an opportunity to check your work and to be careful and just get the right answer. Okay? So, and by the way, how many decimal places should you carry this out to? Two?
16.
Yeah, your calculator will only display 10. Notice what I got. The TI-30X2S, which I always carry this with me because, well, it's solar powered, for one thing. And it's, so I've had this for 15 years now. So I've never had to change a battery or anything. The only thing I worry about is that I'm going to get chalk in the keyboard. And so when that happens, I just get all the chalk out. That's pretty good. So now it's clean. You don't need a graphing calculator for this. You just need a calculator. Now these, doesn't matter, all of these calculators give you about 10 decimal places of accuracy. I don't know if it's necessary to do 10, although if you're going down far enough, your error is going to mount up quite a bit early on anyway. So, you know, you're going to find, and we can do examples of this, you'll find that you'll have an error in the second decimal place or the third decimal place. So the only reason I would carry it out to maybe 6 or 7 is just so that you get reasonably accurate results on subsequent calculations. That doesn't mean your answer's right. It just means that you're doing the best you can with the hardware that you have available to you. Okay. Now, I would go ahead and fill out the number of rows that you need in order to solve the problem. So if you have X... Then as 1, then you've got X1, which is
0.2.
Now, we don't know what Y is. We'll figure that out. And then 2, if N is 2, then you have 0.4. And that's where we're going to stop for this particular problem, because all we need to do is find Y of 0.4. And I may need more space here for my Y value, but probably not. So, okay, so now what do? We take the previous F times H and add it to the previous Y to get the current Y. So the previous HF plus the previous Y is equal to the current Y. So what is the current Y?
Zero.
Now, after you've done a few of these, you get into a pattern. And as long as you're consistent in making the table and using this format, it's going to be really easy to do the arithmetic. So once you fill out a row, then it's really easy to get the next Y. And once you have the X and the Y, then you can do this one and this one. And then you go to the next row. Okay, so now X is 0.2, Y is 0. So 0.2 plus 0 is 0.2. And H times 0.2 is what? 0.04. So you got 0.04 for that entry. If it helps, you can even do horizontal lines to separate these guys, because you don't want to make any mistakes, right? You don't want to go so slow that you don't make any progress, but you don't want to go so fast that you make mistakes. Somehow there's a balance there, and by doing homework you can find that balance for you. Okay, so now how do we find this Y value? Well, it's this number, it's H times F plus this number, so it's 0.04. And so the answer in this particular case is 0.04. Okay? Questions on this? Now,
just for grins, what I want to do is I want to do the same problem, but with a smaller step size, and ask for the same result. In other words, y of 0.4, and see what happens. So I'm going to erase this side over here, and leave this up, and redraw the table. But now we have to do more arithmetic. So again, n, x sub n, y sub n, f of, give myself a little space, f of x sub n, y sub n, h, f of x sub n, y sub n. And now, let's say the step size is h equals 0.1. So, we have twice as many calculations. We start with the same information. So, n equals 0, x sub 0 is 0, y sub 0 is 0. The f is 0, because we're still using the same function here. And point one times 0 is 0. So that hasn't changed. And now, let's go ahead and do n equal 1, so you get x1, which is 0.1. And for n equal 2, you get 0.2. For n equal 3, you get 0.3. For n equal 4, you get 0.4. So instead of calling it quits here, and by the way, it's probably a good idea to circle your final answer there so that you know that that's where you're taking your answer from. We have to go down further in the table to get that answer, which we hope is a good thing, right? Because your step size is smaller, so your error should be smaller, because your deviation from the curve should be less. So now, how did we get y1?
It's equal to the previous plus.
Yeah, so it's hf previous plus y previous. So this one plus this one is 0. And so that's our y1. Now we use that to form this guy. So at this point, nothing's different, except, well, the x is different. So 0.1 plus 0 is 0.1. And 0.1 times 0.1 is 0.01. And now the next y is 0.01 plus 0 is 0.01. Notice already we've got a difference here. So at x equals 0.2, we now have y is 0.01, whereas here we said that y was 0. Okay, now we plug in. Now I'm going to start using the calculator. I can do some of this in my head, but what's the point? So 0.2 plus 0.01 squared. So 0.2 plus 0.01 squared is 0.2001. That's this point right here, 0.2001. And then times 0.1 is 0.02001. Agreed? And now what is the new y value? Well, it's 0.02001 plus 0.01, which is 0.03001. Pretty easy stuff, right? Okay. So then, now we plug these in to our F. So 0.3 plus 0.03001 squared is 0.3009006. And if you multiply that by 0.1, which is our H, then you get 0.03009006. And we take this number plus this number, gives us our new Y value. So so I've already got this number in the calculator.
Oh, I got times it by 0.1. So now I have that.
Plus 0.03001 equals 0.06010006. Or 0.06 for all practical purposes. This is the answer that we want. Now notice 0.06 versus 0.04, that's a 50% error compared to the step size of 0.2. I mean, or it depends on how you look at it, but there's a big difference between 0.04 and 0.06 percentage-wise.
Is there any relation between that, like half the step size and half the error?
Yeah, there are error bounds. We're not going to talk about them, but if you look in section, 8.2 talks about how you find the error bounds.
Is it the same method that they used in Cal 2 and Cal 3 to find error bounds for Euler's method?
Well, for Euler's method, probably, yeah.
Like it was something like K times something over...
No, that wasn't Euler's method. You're thinking of trapezoidal rule and those kinds of things. I don't think they talked about error bounds in Euler's method in Calc 2. But, and of course the error bounds are just those bounds. It's not going to predict the exact error. But so you can see, and if you took H equal to 0.001 or something like that, so much smaller, you'd have to do a lot more calculation, but you would get a much more accurate result. And compare that. And by the way, you can... this is nonlinear equation, so not quite as easy to solve. It's not separable. But if you do this experiment with something that can be solved pretty easily, then... And you'll see the textbook does this too. It'll give a table with different step sizes and different, you know, say the exact result from solving the differential equation and then various step sizes, and you can see the effect of the step sizes. Okay, any questions on this? You guys can do this? Now, one thing I want to mention is we're doing this right after this test, after the first test, so it's going to be on the next test, but one thing that happens sometimes is people forget. You know, you got to really brush up on 2.7. You got to brush up on 8.1. Don't let this stuff fall by the wayside, because where we're headed next is systems of differential equations, and that's going to consume us for a good part of the rest of the course. So, you know, you're going to do the homework. You've already done 2.7, or will soon. Turn that in, but you also need to do 8.1. Take a look at 8.2 and 8.3. You know, just look at them. Look at Runge-Kutta and see what the algorithm looks like. You're not responsible for it, but, you know, it's handy to know kind of what it's all about. And then be sure that you stay fresh on this stuff so that you can do it when called upon to do so. So, if there are no questions, then you guys are free to go. If you didn't sign the sign-in sheet, please do so before you leave. If you didn't get a solution, they're up here.
This is what I'm here from.
Okay, thank you. That's fine, thanks.
Quick question, number 10.
Hold on.